I'd like to introduce our speaker for today, who will speak until 10:10, and then we'll answer any questions from the audience. Let's all welcome Diane from Huntington Beach.
Hi there. I'm Diane. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Diane.
And my sobriety date is April 4th, 1973. Yeah, I know I'm old. That was not the first time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, however. I don't know about any of you, but when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, it didn't feel like home to me in the beginning. I came here when I was 18 because a lot of people had a problem with my drinking. I did not. I was into the experimental stage. How much, how long? And I had aids that I used, things that accompanied my alcohol that helped me last longer. I grew up in the 60s. I'm a child of Timothy Leary and psychedelic prayers and acid when it wasn't illegal and all of those things that just kind of carry your alcoholism to another level. And so I had a lot of lessons to learn. I was talking before the meeting and someone was talking to me about having gone to see the Rolling Stones and doing all this stuff when they were in high school. I drank. That's what I did when I was in high school. I drank, I ran away from home, and I got arrested. And I went to juvenile hall. And when juvenile hall was through with me, I went to correctional school. And then I went promptly to jail. That's what I did. And I did not sleep on toilet paper. I don't know where Chucky went. I did not sleep on toilet paper. I just slept on a really uncomfortable bunk. And none of that made me think that I had a problem because I was very clear what my problem was. You. It was you. It was my parents. It was the teachers in school. Nobody ever understood me. Nobody gave me a break. Nobody was fair to me. I was never enough. Don't know if any of you understand how that feels, but I was the oldest child, and if I got a C, I should have gotten a B. If I got an A, I should have gotten an A+. It didn't matter what I did. It was never enough. Now, that happens a lot. Parents are just trying to get you to try harder. For me, it was never enough. So when I started figuring out what I wanted to be, it always took the shape of something that would make me important. Never real, just important. So I became a surfer early in my life. I had a great surfboard. I can't honestly tell you I was a good surfer because I never went in the ocean. I know. I carried my surfboard. It was red. It was beautiful. And I carried it. I waxed it. But I'm afraid of the ocean because sharks are out there. And I figured with my luck, they would find me. So I just carried the surfboard. And people always used to ask what my nationality was. And for 10 years, it was American Indian. Because I love them. I love American Indians, and I think they're important. And I think people always took notice when I said, I'm an American Indian. I'm Czechoslovakian. I know. That is so sad. I am Czechoslovakian and British and a million other little things, but I am not American Indian. And that was the hardest thing I ever had to give up in my life. I got to tell you, it was so hard. I went to meetings for a while, and about 6 months sober, a guy said, Diane, I want you to come out and do some work with our people. Yeah. I wasn't big on honesty, but I just couldn't do that. I said, you know, I'm not an American Indian. But I still love them. I became Czechoslovakian. I also learned how to be honest in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned how to tell the truth. And you know how I learned that? I lied and I stole all your money. That's how I learned to be honest. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous without any redeeming characteristics. Everything in life was about me. What you did to me, what I didn't get, what I needed. That's who I was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And let me just tell you that as much as my behavior has changed, if I stop coming here and hanging out with you, that's who I am. That is who I go back to if I don't spend time with you, if I don't do the steps, if I don't make myself useful to you and to God. That's who I am. So I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous finally when I was 25, and I had just been beaten senseless by the world, and I still had an attitude. Seriously, you would think that by then I would just say, yes, I'll do the steps, give me two sponsors, whatever you want, I will do it. And you know what? I didn't. I sat in meetings, I listened to people talk, and then I argued with them because I had ideas about stuff. I knew things, not anything in the book, but I knew things. So I argued. I got a sponsor when I was fairly new because she said the F word from the podium, which I will not do today out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. But she did, and at that time, that's what I identified with. She was a thief. She used to go sober and steal from the stores. I loved her. And she didn't take any crap from anybody. I really loved her. And her name was Crazy Annie. Later, they started calling her Irish Annie. And she was one of the most amazing recovering women I have ever met. I asked her to be my sponsor. And she said, you know, I wish you weren't so much like me. I would like you better. But yeah, I'll sponsor you. So we started this journey together, and she and I parted ways after a while because she wanted me to do the steps. And so I got another sponsor, and her name was Angie, and she's a little Mexican, wonderful, recovering woman in sobriety. Just turned 80, and not years sober, but she's like 50 or something years sober. And she sponsored me for a while, and then it was just too hard. You know what it's like when you are a person, if somebody tells you what to do, you can't do it. And if they tell you not to do it, you've got to do it once. I mean, I was the kid in the car. My dad would say, one more peep and I'll hit you. And I would peep. I mean, I wouldn't even talk. I would just peep. Because I wanted to see what would happen. I always pushed, and I had so much trouble having people tell me what to do, and sponsors tell you what to do. So that's why I had a hard time getting a job. You get a job, they tell you what to do. But Angie told me I really needed a job. So she said, just sit down with a paper, mark out the things you can do, and go apply. That's all you have to do, go apply. If you get the job, great. If you don't get the job, great. So I circled a couple of things because, you know, I got to tell you, I didn't really pay attention in school. And I went to college for a couple of years, but I really didn't go to any of the classes. I just drank and got high. And it was just, yeah, I had a lot of incompletes. You don't get a lot of credit for that. So I had trouble finding a job. And I circled this one job, driving. I could drive. They needed a pickup and delivery person. I could do that. So I went and applied, and the guy showed me this little pickup truck. And I looked at it. It was a stick shift. No woman in my family has ever driven a stick shift. And I explained that to him, and he said, you know, look, there's directions on the knob. And there are. It doesn't say put in the clutch, but it does tell you what direction to go in. And he tried to explain to me about the clutch. And I'm sure that that truck was never the same after I drove it. But I learned how to drive a stick shift. I learned how to do it. And I got that job. And I had that job for about a year and a half. I had it for about 3 months, and their typesetter quit. And at that time, they were doing typesetting on old IBM Composers. He asked me if I wanted the typesetting job because if I knew how to type. I knew how to type because in school, if you take typing, you don't have homework. I took typing every year I could. No homework. And I knew how to type, so I got that job. And from that job, I got a job working for a publishing company, doing their typesetting. And then their managing editor quit. Yeah, I've always been really good with words, just naturally really good with words. And so I became the managing editor of a publishing company. And I had that job for 28 years. Loved that job. It was a great job. And I listened to somebody else earlier talk about things don't always go your way. Things aren't always the way you want them. Sometimes things are hard. And last year, in March, they eliminated my position at that company. So I lost my job. Publishing isn't doing really well. And after 28 years, I didn't have a job. So every day I'm going to look for a job on the internet, looking for a job, sending resumes. Nobody's responding to me. And a month after I lost my job, a big Suburban killed my car, just totaled me. So I have no car and I have no job. And if it were me, I would be so depressed and so angry that I would never see what the next step should be. But because I've turned my life and my will over to God, and because I hang out with you, and I listen to your stories, and I have hope here. A friend of mine from a meeting, her in-laws had an old car, just an old car, that they were trying to give to their grandkids, but the grandkids said it was an old person's car. So they gave it to me. She gave me this car. It's a great little car, and it's a blue, and I like it. Great car. I would have never appreciated anything this much in my first 20 years of sobriety. It took me all the lessons of making mistakes and learning and taking money from my home group and having to pay them back and getting caught in lies and learning how to tell the truth and starting exactly where I am so that I could get somewhere real. I don't know how to get anywhere real if I don't start with who I am. So I did that. And then a friend of mine in a meeting said, listen, my receptionist has taken maternity leave. I desperately need someone to just fill in. You can look for a job while you're here. Just fill in for a little while, half a day, that's all. So, hey, it's better for me to be productive at this point than it is to sit home and worry about what I don't have. So I went to be a receptionist. I mean, I can answer the phone, and I actually can smile at people today, say welcome, and mean it. So I sat in the little front office, and I did my little job for a month, and they called me in the office and said, we have a full-time opening in human resources. Would you like that position? Now, I must tell you the truth. I know nothing about human resources except for what they didn't do for me, right? I mean, human resources, that's what they are. They're the bad guys all the way around. So that's all I knew about it, except for that's what came up. And I had been sending resumes every day to dozens of places, and that's what came up. And if I've learned anything in 40 years, I've learned pay attention to what comes up. And if you can do it, do it. So that's what came up. And last July, I've been there ever since. I do that job. And I actually like that job. And people do get really mad at me. Because I have to give them bad news from time to time. But one of the things I know is that it's not personal. Life is not all about me. There's a great deal of life about you. It's amazing. I spent my first 3 or 4 years struggling in Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I found people who wanted to take me places to be of service. This friend of mine, Jerry, who is 53 years sober this year, he started taking me to general service. He started taking me to GSR meetings, to assemblies. And I didn't know why he was doing that, because all they did is argue. They argued about stuff. I didn't know what they were talking about. What is general service? Do you know what general service is? I had no idea. So I went with him anyway, because he was cute and I liked he and his wife, and they were nice to me and they had parties. So I went to general service with him. I didn't go with any idea that that would change my life. But I must tell you that being of service has changed my life. I was in H&I for a couple of years, and then I went to general service. And what happened for me in general service is I finally figured out what it is. It's the heartbeat of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's where we make decisions as a group that each one of us alone would probably make differently. But as a group, we make decisions that ascertain Alcoholics Anonymous's future, so that our children and their children and their children will be able to get help from this disease, will be able to recover from a seemingly hopeless disease of mind and body. That's what general service is about. And when I went back there the first time, oh, I forgot to tell you, I was an elected district committee person in my area, and I got to have a gavel to call. It's seriously, it is such a rush to have power in AA, because you really don't ever have any. But the imagination can do wonderful things. So I had this gavel, and I got to start the meeting and tell people when to talk, and I really liked that. So then we went to a general assembly, and they had an election, and they were electing all the officers of the area committee. And I looked at the officers. There's an alternate delegate, there's a delegate, there's a chairperson, there's a treasurer, and there's a secretary. I knew I couldn't do the treasurer because I already stole the money from my group, and I promised I wouldn't be treasurer anywhere for a while. So I knew I couldn't do that. And I looked at the other ones, and I thought, you know what, God, I'll do anything but secretary. Seriously, anything but secretary. So I was elected secretary. I know. What that did for me is it caused me to listen, because I had to take notes of those meetings. I had to pay attention to what everybody said, because I had to document that. I listened like I had never listened in any meeting before. And it is amazing what you can learn if you just pay attention. That's where I figured out what general service did. I watch people. The next election, I was elected. I was actually drawn out of the hat as delegate, and I got to go to New York in 82 and 83 as the delegate of this area. It was, I wish everybody could do that. I wish everybody could do that for at least a year. It's an amazing experience. It changed the way I looked at what's important in Alcoholics Anonymous, because people, I would listen to them argue there. I would listen to them. Things would come up. Anonymity breaks. What we should do for this, what we should do for that. And I would listen to them talk about it. And they didn't agree with each other. Oh, cool. Yeah, you actually have a clock there, but thank you. I'm paying attention. Thank you. Okay. See, this is the thing about being 65. It might not look that way on the outside, but on the inside, I forget what I'm talking about if I distract myself. No, no, it's not your fault. I should have just shut up and gone on. But, oh, I remember. I was watching people talk about things and argue about things, and everybody had an opinion, and most of their opinions seemed right to them. Most of them did. And some of them were contrary to each other. And I watched the process where people would discuss things. And in Nevada, in Florida, in Louisiana, in Canada, in Iowa, the needs of Alcoholics Anonymous are not all the same. They're not the same as they are in California. So I would watch people actually listen to what Alcoholics Anonymous needed in other areas and change their vote so that what was needed somewhere else became more important than what they didn't like. That changed me. It changed the way I listen to you. It changed the way I listen in an AA meeting. Because I might not like everything that people say, but I have learned more from what I don't like than I have from what's easy for me. So that was my experience with General Service. The other thing I know is that my life is about being useful. If I'm not being useful, I'm not happy. And it would have never been my choice to make my life about that, because I liked what you did for me. That was my comfort zone in the first years. I am only happy when I am being useful to you and to God. I also had a very dysfunctional family, probably surprises you. My family, I have a very paranoid sister with no apparent alcoholism because she doesn't drink. But she's paranoid. And I have a brother who cannot ever keep a commitment, ever. And you know, that's cool when you're 30, but it's not so cool when you're 62. So my dad and my mom all have their issues. They all did. The truth is, I love all of them. And I learned what I know about love from a guy who was, he lives in Arizona now, but his name was Rod. And he told me that, Diane, love is a genuine concern for another person's happiness and well-being, whether they're with you or not. Whether they're on your side, whether they're with you, whether you ever see them again, love is a genuine concern for their happiness and well-being. If you can do that, you love somebody. I learned how to do that here. I love my family. I look at them, I see them exactly where they are. I don't require them to ever see me, because you do. You satisfy that need for me. You're able to see me where I am, and you don't ask me to be somebody else. I owe you for the rest of my life for that. I would drive to the other side of the country if it was necessary for me to help someone recover from alcoholism, because I owe you. I know who I am. Sorry. I know who I am. I know who I am without you. I don't want to be that. I am so grateful that the people who were in my early sobriety saw past who I was to who God wanted me to be, and just kept hanging in there with me until I got through it. There are things that have happened in life for me that have been very difficult. I had a therapist once commit suicide. It was very difficult for me. What I know is, you can, just because people can help other people see the light, it doesn't mean they see it. I don't want to be someone who doesn't see the light. I don't want to be someone who is above or beyond you. I want to be one among many. I am so much happier when I'm one among many. I have a relationship with everyone in my family. And when my dad died 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, I did not have any regrets. Because for the entire 37 years I was sober during his life, I spent time with him. I took him places. He had Alzheimer's for 12 years. And I hung out with him, and I made him laugh. And he made me laugh. And I loved him. And I know he loved me. We have such magic here, such an opportunity. For God's sake, don't miss it because you think you have a good idea. You don't. Thank you.
We have time for question and answer period. And I'll now turn the meeting over to our speaker for till 10:25.
Well, hello again. So I assume this part is dependent on you. Do you have any questions? Thank you, sir. He asked what tribe or tribes was I from. And you know what? I tried really hard not to have to say. It was usually enough because I look a little American Indian and most people didn't ask me. Once in a while, I was a Sioux. Once in a while, I was a Cherokee. I tried not to get into the ones I was not completely familiar with, because then my lie would be found out quickly. I'm happier being a Czechoslovakian who loves American Indians, because it's just who I am. And I'm happy to answer any questions, but I also wanted to speak to somebody who said something about fear earlier, because I agree that fear and faith can live together, but if I'm controlled by my fear, it's not effective. So what I have found is that I can't be controlled by fear here. I'm afraid to speak, but if I don't, then fear controls my life and faith doesn't work. I'm afraid to drive over bridges. I'm terrified of heights. I do it anyway if I have to get where I'm going. I don't want to be controlled by fear. That's the difference today. I'm still afraid from time to time. Yes?
Did you get sober in Orange County?
Yes, sir, I did. I got sober in Midway City, which is right next to Huntington Beach. And I've stayed in the same little area. Actually, I do. I go to more meetings now than I did when I was new. Because when I was new, you were telling me I had to, so I didn't want to. But now, I go to meetings to stay balanced. I have a lot of stuff that goes on in my life on a daily basis, and I find peace here in meetings. I find hope here. And I definitely find love here. So it behooves me. I go to probably 5 meetings a week. Yes?
Do you have a regular regimen?
As far as meetings go, or as far as meditation? And yeah, I do, and it changes. I have to tell you, another thing I learned about myself is that I can get bored, and if I do, I'm in dangerous territory. So every couple of years, every 3 years, I change it up. I go to a different meeting, I meet a different group of people, and I don't always let go of other meetings, which is why I have more now, and sometimes I do have to let go. I get up every morning. I know it says upon awakening, but I'm 65, and I wake up at 1, 2, 3, and 5. So upon awakening was not working for me. I decided that I take a shower every day. Every day. In the morning, I take a shower. Lucky you, huh? I pray in the shower. Every morning, I get up, and when I get in the shower, I say all my prayers. If anybody's on my prayer list, I add them. I say the third step prayer to start. And then I always thank God for what he's given me and taken away and left me with. And then I just move through my day, what I need. And I do as many minutes of meditation as I can in the morning, where I just sit quietly and see if I can hear anything. And then I start my day, and I go to meetings at night. And if anybody calls me at any time and needs anything in regard to Alcoholics Anonymous, I go there. I was talking to him about the Rolling Stones, and just so you'll know that I'm not just telling you stuff. When the Rolling Stones were in Anaheim, just recently, I had an opportunity to go. A friend of mine, her husband got this suite at the Rolling Stones concert, and I had an opportunity to go, and she asked me about 3 days before if I wanted to go. And I was speaking in Long Beach. And I know I could have gotten somebody else to do it. I know I could have. And I would have loved to see the Rolling Stones. But I'm not sober because I choose what I do. I'm not sober because I choose what comes up. I do what comes up. And so I went to speak in Long Beach. And all my friends had a wonderful time and sent me hundreds of pictures of them having a wonderful time. And you know what? It was great. Because I have peace today. I know I did what I needed to do. And I would have not felt right about going to the Rolling Stones. And that's what it's about for me. My regimen is doing the things that put me right with me. If I'm not right with me, I'm not going to be right with you. And I'm certainly not going to be right with God. So did that answer your question or did I get off? Thank you. Anybody else? Yes, it happened very slowly. The first 20 years I was sober was a learning experience. I got married, I got divorced, I stole all the money from my home group, I lied about everything. I didn't show up, I got incredibly depressed. A lot changed in that 20 years. Because I paid attention and I took them as lessons, and not judgments, I was able to get through them and move on. And this 20 years has been so much better, so peaceful. One quick one?
What's the most difficult thing you've been through?
The most difficult thing I've been through in sobriety. I think being depressed for 4 years was probably the most difficult thing I went through because I was so hopeless when I was alone, but I was not alone when I was with you. And people came to my house. I ended up really struggling through that 4 years without ever thinking I would come out on the other side. But I kept coming to meetings and I kept hanging out with you. And without me even understanding why, one day I woke up and I smiled and I was so happy to be here and so happy to be alive. Don't quit when you're halfway through. That's not the destination. I have to quit now.
Thank you again.